Thanks, Sean. There was a heck of a lot in there that you put forward, but maybe let's start with a pendulum to begin with.
Yeah.
Just explain in practical measures what we should be doing with a BizNews portfolio, because now we've produced incredible returns, nearly 20% compound for 10 years. But we've been in North America, in tech stocks, and I mean, even I'm not optimistic enough to say that you're going to be able to even hold on to that if the pendulum swings, which it will, which it must. So where would you be, what would you be doing with the NVIDIAs, the Palantirs and those stocks? Where would you be switching? Because I'm sure there's a heck of a lot of people who are sitting in exactly the same situation.
You know, Alec, the beautiful thing about being a value investor is before we buy something, we try and decide what it's worth. And then that tells us what to do. Okay, if you go for a story and you go, let's just pick the wind farm, and I was at a value investing conference this morning here in London, and one of the guys put up a picture of windmills, and they're all on fire. I think AI had generated these slides, which I thought was quite an interesting thing. Sorry about my boring slides. I should have seen that a little earlier. But if you just go for a story, when do you sell? Because your story is, oh, I want to go for wind energy, and wind's going to be a future part of the energy transition. Great. But at what point do you sell those? Because those wind is still going to be a future part of our energy transition, but you're down 70% on those shares. Okay, so with us, we look at it and we go, what do we think this company is worth based on normal earnings and a fair exit multiple? So we decide what it's worth, and then we know what to do. So I would say, you know, what is Palantir worth? I mean, what do you think it's going to earn? What do you think an exit multiple is? What's your upside from here? But I do think you want to be thinking about taking profits. And it's not just me. Look, Stanley Druckenmiller took profits in NVIDIA. Don't know if you saw that recently, okay? Warren Buffett took profits in Apple. Now, that was only 13% of his holding, but we don't know what he's done subsequent to quarter end. And he didn't really need the cash because he had a whole lot of cash anyway. So, you know, is there much upside left? And I'll tell you one interesting story. When I was in South Africa recently, just this last week, on Monday, I had breakfast with an IT entrepreneur. He's a friend of mine, and I've known him for a long time, and he's a very, very successful individual. And I was asking him about AI, and this is a point that he made, which I didn't know. I thought it was brilliant. He said that at the moment, what's happening is because AI is so new, every query you put into the AI search engine, it starts from scratch, okay? What the search engines do in normal search, look at Google, you know, they know that millions of people every day are going to wake up and go, Google, or Siri, what's the weather going to be like in London today? And they're going to go, it's going to be rainy, okay? But so they answer that question and store that answer in cache so that when you ask the question, it's not going back to the servers in the States or Iceland or wherever they are and generating it from scratch. Now, what's happening at the moment is an AI, every question's going back to those servers, and so you need huge processing power to do that. Okay. But very soon they're gonna be putting those answers in cache, which means a reduction in the processing needs. And I was quite intrigued to see the CapEx bills that Microsoft and Alphabet that I've seen in the latest quarter was actually a little bit less than I thought. And so we'll have to watch and see what NVIDIA's results are going to be. But, you know, would I be surprised if it disappointed? Expectations are so high that that it's going to be hard not to disappoint, I would guess. Okay, so I don't know what for certain. I've got no crystal balls. I just say, on the balance of probabilities, do I think my upside from NVIDIA from here versus my potential downside if they disappoint? Look at Arm. Arm disappointed. Revenue was disappointing. You had Supermicro also disappointed. And these guys are supposed to be AI poster childs. So I think there's a lot of risk in those stocks right now. And that's what I would say. Take profits.
Okay, let's put it differently. The reason why we have all of those stocks in the portfolio is really because of exponential companies and growing anything that grows at 25% a year, which all of those companies are, you then extrapolate that by using just a little spreadsheet and the numbers become extraordinary. When you look at a company that's growing fast, how many years do you put that in your portfolio for? And I think that gets down to the essence of it. If we now look at NVIDIA today and say it's going to grow at 40% a year for the next 10 years, then the price is well justified. But of course, a lot can happen in those 10 years. So how do you as a value investor, because when you're doing those number crunches, how many years out do you feel certain about exponential companies' growth rates?
Well, I mean, there's two things. The one is, you know, Warren Buffett said he doesn't even know what earnings are going to be next quarter. So putting numbers out 5 years, you know, things always look profitable in a spreadsheet because you multiply, 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 you know, column H, it all looks wonderful. It looks like I'm going to make a fortune until the number in column B falls short and then boom, the compounded effect is a disaster. So if you actually look at analysts' forecast track record, it's terrible. So that's why you think about how do I get a return? I get a return from dividends, I get a return from earnings growth, and I get a return from re-rating on that earnings growth. Okay. Well, they don't pay dividends and you've had a massive re-rating. So now if the earnings doesn't come through, you got a big problem on your hands. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, yes, earnings and revenue might go up, but the share prices have run well ahead of that. Okay. So, you know, and if you stand back and you look at it and you go, Cisco and guys like Nortel Networks, they built the components of the internet. And if we were standing back in 1999, you know, what do we know about the internet there? We're going to have a lot more data. Yes, but we didn't know about streaming. We didn't know about Meta. We didn't know about Instagram. We didn't know about all these things that have used huge amounts of data, far more than we've ever thought. But if you'd bought Cisco there, you'd be underwater. Still, 24 years later. So, you know, rather use the beneficiaries of those things. We, you know, you could have said, oh, well, the internet's going to be amazing. Let's go buy Cisco. Yeah, but who's benefited from that? Oh, Amazon and Alphabet and Microsoft, and they benefited from the internet. So use the, you know, not the actual plumbing, use the beneficiaries. And I think, and at BizNews, I talked about it, you know, there are lots of companies. Banks are benefiting from AI, you know, because of chatbots. And look, every day, banks are coming out with good numbers. And people are underweight banks. Food retailers, I think, are benefiting from AI. eBay, those kinds of companies. Lots of companies are benefiting from AI, and they're not having to pay the capex.
No, it's such an interesting story because a couple of years ago, visiting with a value investor in London, I was recommended to read a book called Engines That Move Markets. And that is, it has transformed a lot of thinking. It's by a guy called Nen, who worked for John Templeton. And he analyzed the major changes in society over the last 300 years or so, going back to telegraph, telephone, etc., right up until the internet. Of course, not AI, because it was written a while ago. And his thesis was, it's very easy to find the losers, but almost impossible to find the winners. And I think when you look at motor vehicles at the turn of the century, who would have known the winners would have been? So why do we know that Tesla is going to be a winner of electric vehicles and so on, and yet it's been priced accordingly?
Well, I think that's right. And I mean, you know, there are parks of cars, of Chinese cars, that cost 10,000 euros, I think it is, or 10,000 pounds. Like, I mean, car parks full of them, of exports that are in Amsterdam and ports in Europe. And even if you put 100% tariff on, that's 20 grand, you're still cheaper than these other things. So Tesla, you know, there's a great, in fact, this is quite useful, there's a great capital cycle comment, and there's a book called Capital Account by Edward Chancellor, and what they talk about there is, and it comes back to the pendulums, where there's been a lot of capital thrown at an industry, what that means is future returns will be lower. And that's just because capital is thrown at the industry, it builds capacity, now you've got excess capacity, lower price, it means excess supply, lower prices. That's exactly what's happened in EVs. So everybody's looked at Tesla, thought, oh, those guys are making some money, let's all start making EVs. And so now you had all the BMW, VW, Porsche, the whole lot, okay? And new competitors all building EV plants. Now what's happened? The markets are awash with EVs. Tesla's results are terrible, you know? I mean, revenue was down, profits were down. You know, he tried to spin a story about, oh, well, don't worry, you're going to make a cheaper car. Fantastic. Cheaper cars, they were way more profitable.
No, his story was automated vehicles.
Yeah, well.
Which won't work in South Africa. Our taxis are far too aggressive.
I don't even know if it'll work in the States.
Will it work?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No. Well, I'm not going to pay for it. If it works, that's a bonus, but I'm not paying for it.
Okay. Well, let's not argue that one. But
no, but you
tell
see
us
the point
what
about
you
capital.
Are investing in. What is yeah. the when you those pendulums clearly you are swinging.
Yeah.
But where is it that you are now finding great opportunities, and the turnaround situation in South Africa? Let's hope. I mean, let's hope that what France is saying is that people grow a backbone. They get more Rob. You know, they find their inner Rob Herseffs, and they stand up and say things that Rob Herseff would have said if he's here with us now, which is don't just allow the bayonet to go through the soft part. Let's just say that happens in South Africa. Is it priced for Armageddon?
I don't know if it is because, we've got Hong Kong listed stocks that are just as cheap. I've got companies, you know, ABN AMRO, 8% dividend yields. It's not far off ABSA. And I've got residential property in the Netherlands is increasing. And I've got strong economies. I've got Hong Kong stocks with close to double-digit dividend yields with entrepreneurs, the revenue's growing. So I don't think South Africa has a monopoly on cheapness, unfortunately. It's one of many emerging markets you saw there. Emerging markets are cheap. Not every emerging market's expensive apart from South Africa. So that's the problem that South Africa faces. And then the very good companies are expensive. ShopRite's on 22 times earnings. I can buy a food retailer internationally on 10 or 8. I don't have to pay 22 times. So, so that's the one of the challenges, I think. So where are we finding opportunities? In emerging markets, outside the US, Europe. You can have a look at our fact sheet and see our top 10. And, companies like GlaxoSmithKline, I spoke about in last month's fact sheet, 5% dividend yield, 11 times earnings, growing revenue. But it's an out-of-favor UK stock market. You know, we've got a UK asset manager that I think is on 3x earnings with more than half the market cap in cash. And their assets are growing because the market's going up. So there are lots of these kinds of opportunities out there. It's not just, I'd love to say South Africa's an absolute sitting duck. But we've only got one South African share, and that's AECI. Okay, and you think about, explosives and the gold price is up, more explosives, and they're hopefully selling their German operation. And it's a global leader, number 3 in the world, at a huge discount to its international competitors. And so, that's the only South African share we own.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you've got this pendulum that swung to North America, and there's a heck of a lot of other assets that have become really, really cheap on the other side. Just go and look around, not necessarily in South Africa, because we are just one of a number.
I think that's right, Alec. I mean, unfortunately, if you look at, South Africa, okay, we've got Naspers, which is exposed to Chinese tech, great. And we've got Alibaba and Baidu in the portfolio. We think those are great companies. You know, tobacco, is tobacco the future? Don't think so. Is it really cheap? I don't know. They've got a lot of debt. Things getting better there? Don't think so.
What about banking? And not just South Africa, but European banking?
Oh, like Europe. Yeah, we've got lots of European banks in the portfolio.
Why?
Well, because they're out of favor and things are actually improving and they're cheap. So I mentioned ABN AMRO. I think it's 60 cents in the dollar. Barclays, you're paying 0.6 times book value.
Just explain what that means.
Well, it means if they shut up shop tomorrow and collected 100, okay, you're only paying 60 for that 100. So now if they grow earnings, then which they're all doing, and they're using technology to cut costs and all the rest. You know, the problem was banking has been a very difficult place to be in Europe in recent years because interest rates have been next to nothing. How on earth do you make a buck when your selling price is naught? And so lots of investors have said, oh, these are horrible businesses. Well, they're only horrible businesses because interest rates are naught. But some of the oldest businesses in the world are banks. If you think of, Barclays and UBS, and these things were all founded hundreds of years ago. Okay, so yes, there have been some failures if those businesses have been badly managed. But if they're well managed, these banks should know what their loan book's going to generate over the duration of the loan for years. Apple doesn't know how many iPhones are going to sell next quarter. So we think they're actually quite good businesses. And I'll pay my mortgage before I go out to a restaurant. I'll pay my mortgage before I'm buying my next Nike, and if times are tough, I'll make coffee at home. I won't buy a Starbucks. So, and that's what we're seeing actually in Europe. In the US, what we're seeing is times are tough. Starbucks sales were down. You know, Home Depot sales and were disappointing. Those things on 20 times earnings plus. And same store sales is negative. So we like those resiliency of the banks. You've got annuity income. I mean, who's changed their banks? And these things, these companies, Alec, these companies on 6 times earnings that people don't own.
So
and they're
buying
back stock.
Dollars worth of asset for 60 cents,
yeah.
Effectively,
in
when you
buy
European.
Correct.
And if Putin does something crazy?
Well, if Putin does something crazy, I won't want to own NVIDIA either. You know, so that's the, yeah.
All right, Mr. Putin, please don't do anything crazy. Let's move on to the questions and actually the turnaround.
Okay.
Turnaround, the South African turnaround, well, the turnaround situation, the South African one. Sure, quite a few here.
Oh, boy.
Here's an idea. Reduce Fidelity Insurance on corporations that have approved whistleblowing processes. Wendy, that sounds like a really good one. What do you think?
Reduce
Fidelity Insurance,
okay,
on corporations that have approved whistleblowing processes.
I mean, look, we want simplicity. We've got to have simplicity. You know, we got too many things and we want to go for the easy wins. We want the low-hanging fruit. So that doesn't sound like low-hanging fruit to me. I mean, it sounds like a good idea, but it sounds like a difficult thing to implement. I mean, low-hanging fruit, foreign visas. That's low-hanging fruit. It's easy to do. And then people will come. You know, just think about this, Alec. You know, there are houses going in these fancy estates for 20 million rand easily. Okay. You get 1,000 people, and that's so each house you'll be paying 13% transfer duty. That's 2 million rand transfer duty for every foreigner who comes in and buys one of those. Those are big numbers. You multiply that by a few thousand.
Transfer duty, as someone who's recently purchased a property, is very sore.
There you go.
So if you've got the foreigners paying into that pot,
yeah,
it would be a very good thing. Whereas in Hermanus, you're seeing that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people coming in and buying anyway, because they're fearing what's happening in other parts of the world.
But what's happening? Foreigners can come in, they spend 3 months, then they get chased out of these estates. So they're not going to fancy restaurants, driving around, paying their domestic worker, etc. Okay. You know, 3 months, they've got to go home because you only allow a 3-month visa.
So
it's crazy.
Come there, spend 6 months at
no,
least.
No, spend the whole year. Live there.
Okay. Well, very good. Low-hanging fruit. Estate duty,
yeah,
says Graham, at 40% payable only on estates worth more than 50 million rand. And primary residential property excluded. Isn't that why Johann Rupert financially emigrated?
No, but they must abolish estate duty. Abolish estate duty. That's what I'm saying.
Are you saying abolish
it? I'm saying abolish it.
Okay.
Because it doesn't bring any money and it chases people with money away. I mean, it's the same thing here. As soon as you've made money, you look at the wealthy people here. As soon as they've made money, they're going to live in Guernsey or Mauritius or Singapore or whatever. They leave. They don't want to be exposed to estate duty.
Is that really a big enough reason?
I mean, oh, definitely. I mean, I know people who are leaving because they're changing the non-dom rule, okay? And they're taking children out of private schools and they're selling their houses and they're going. And so they're not eating at the restaurants.
Going where?
Oh, I mean, Italy, Spain, 24% tax, that's it.
But where are their friends? Where are their support? You make new friends in Italy, do you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, probably their friends are going as well. No, but Alec, it's a real thing. It's a real thing.
That people are actually leaving a country.
Definitely.
Just because they don't want to pay a bit of tax.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
I suppose.
But less stick, more carrot. So just come and, you know, let's just encourage them.
Justin says, what role do you think economic nationalism and the likely coming US-China tariff and trade wars will have on value investing?
I think we're quite well exposed to that. Because what difference does US-China tariff have on European banks? Nothing. Okay. In fact, Europe could benefit. I think Europe could benefit from a trade war. Okay. What is it? What? How do you think China's going to retaliate? Maybe they're going to retaliate. Remember, Apple's 20% of sales, and most of their chips are most of their phones are made there. It's an easy target. And NVIDIA. A lot of those chips are made there. I think large US tech is very exposed to this risk.
And a Donald Trump presidency?
Beggars belief.
But I think
it's a disaster, because I think you're going to say there's more risk now in America with Donald Trump and China and all the rest. It's a perfect catalyst to move money elsewhere, and now you're exposed to those flows and the benefits of being invested outside the US.
Okay, so that again supports your thesis of the pendulum swinging too far in the one direction. Dirk's question was, what do we know about CBDCs? They say it will be the vehicle to bring financial equity to developing countries.
I don't know anything about CBDCs.
Okay. All right.
I'm not the guy to ask about digital currencies.
Still not. Bitcoin, not even 2%.
Not interested.
Why are you not interested?
Because I don't have time to. Because the only reason to buy those things is in the hope that somebody else is going to take them off my hands at a higher price. You're not getting dividends. You know, that's the only reason to buy them.
And so, gold?
Yeah, gold. Oh, here we go. Okay.
Digital dollars or digital rands.
I'm a bottom-up investor. I don't worry about macro stuff.
Another question here from Wendy. Are investors being influenced by green stocks?
I mean, you know, my LinkedIn narrative is hashtag numbers, not narrative. And I think there's a real risk in focusing too much on the story. And that's what I was saying with EVs. You know, are EVs going to be increasing? Sure, but you're down 60% on Tesla. You know, wind farm, you're down. So one's got to be careful about paying too much for stories. And so, you know, green, what are we finding now that... I mean, things like defense stocks used to be non-ESG friendly, but actually defense stocks arguably, or defense companies arguably prevent war. You've got Patriot missiles actually saving the destruction of places. So I think you're going to see a change there. And I think that people have, you know, everybody wanted to be an ESG investor because you had large tech companies were big components of those. And yet Amazon's got 30,000 trucks and hundreds of airplanes. I mean, I always found it, I did a thing a while ago, and Amazon was the third largest company in the Morgan Stanley ESG Aware, North America ESG Aware Fund. Okay, they had more airplanes, they generate more emissions than Delta Airlines, and Delta Airlines was nowhere to be seen. So it can get a bit blurred, and I'd just be a bit careful about that stuff. You know, as fund managers, we love to find what's the latest thing, and then launch a fund and then market it because we know it'll sell. Okay? And that's what's happening. That's what's happened.
James asks, what would you do with the European bank exposure in the event that the ECB cuts rates ahead of the US Fed?
I mean, again, I'm a bottom-up investor. So, you know, how much are interest rates going to go down? Are they going back down to where they were? No. No central banker. You know, last time I went back down to where they were, we had meme stocks and SPACs and, you know, venture capital excess and excess on property. So there's no way as interest rates are going back down to where they were. Maybe they fall 25, 50 basis points. Who knows? But I don't think it really moves the needle. And, you know, I just don't make calls based on what we think interest rates are going to do and then rush out and act accordingly.
Sean, you introduced me to this concept of second-level thinking from Howard Marks. Would you share it with us?
Well, first-level thinking is like the initial response. So let's give you an example. When Russia invaded Ukraine, gas prices went up, and we use a lot of gas here in Europe because it keeps us warm. And so gas prices went up and everybody said, oh boy, there's going to be a recession in Europe. So we need to sell European stocks. That's first level thinking. Okay. Join the dots and that's it. We're selling European stocks, recession in Europe, gas prices have gone up. But there were some companies that had hedged the gas price. So they weren't paying the higher gas prices. And actually, if your competitors hadn't hedged the gas price, you were in a stronger position than your competitors. Your competitors are going to go bust. Okay, so that was we were saying, hang on, there's some companies that are actually going to benefit from this. And also there's some companies, people were just selling European stocks en masse. were some companies that had big US operations, and now the euro's down, so your offshore earnings has actually gone up as a component of in terms of translation. So actually earnings are going to grow. So you have to go and find those companies, you know, so that is second level thinking. First level thinking, China's uninvestable because they arrested Jack Ma and put him in jail for, you know, well, he disappeared from sight for a few months. China's uninvestable. Okay, well, that is all companies or just technology companies? That was when, that was pre the bursting of the property bubble in China. And the property bubble bursting has impacted job creation in China. So these IT companies are huge job creators. So why do we want to go and put pressure on those guys now? So you got to try and think beyond just the obvious. First level thinking is obvious. Okay. Second level thinking is taking it a step further. And we saw listen to great examples today about first level thinking, oh well, South Africa's unemployment's really high. Second level thinking, but hang on, all these things are just being excluded from the data. So I'd really encourage people to take it the step further. The nice thing about not worrying about macro, and this is quite an important point, that, you know, that everybody's fear was there was a European recession, and we weren't worrying about that. So now the stock's all sold off. So, and we're buying them at the lows. If there was a recession, well, you bought them at the lows. If there wasn't a recession, well, now you've got an absolute bargain. So you get the asymmetry by not listening to everybody else. So whereas if you pay for wind and then wind wobbles, okay, all of a sudden wind energy is the future, yeah. But then those companies, well, that means the commodity prices have gone up. They gave fixed prices. Now the commodity prices have gone up. They're taking on board debt. And that's what's happened. Okay, so you have to take it the next step. Is that second level thinking. And that's what we try and do. And it's hard because the newspapers are just headlines, you know.
Okay. So we are grateful to Sean for giving us some drinks. We're going to be going there in a moment. Ranmore sponsored it. Thank you, Sean. It's really, you always help us. You always support us, which we always appreciate. But the last question really.
Yeah.
We have an election in 2 weeks' time today. What is second-level thinking for a South African voter?
Oh, goodness me. Catching me on the hop here. Second-level thinking. Well, what is the first-level thinking? What everybody's saying? There's the second-level thing is going to be a unique outcome that we haven't thought about. Okay? I think that's what's going to happen. You know, maybe, I mean, yeah. So I'm not entirely sure. I mean, France will probably be far better positioned to answer this than me. But what is everybody saying and what's going to be different? Maybe, yeah, and then see if there's an opportunity there. I think the second level thinking is, you know what, does it matter? Does it really matter if we've got the entrepreneurs, the lady's still going to be selling her toilet paper? And they're still going to be building back rooms and South Africans will find a way because we always do. And so maybe it actually doesn't matter. Maybe that's the second level thinking. I don't know. That everyone's focused on this. You know, it's a bit like, I love the analogy. In fact, I was on the plane with Nick Mallett. I was hoping to catch him at the luggage carousel, but I think he got caught up in the South African passport queue because I wanted to go and chat to him. And a number of his siblings taught me and coached me. His brother Dave. My under 11 rugby team was the best we ever played rugby. So I wanted him to pass that on. But it's a bit like rugby when everybody's watching and expecting the ball to go down the back line and then the scrum half or the eighth man picks it up and runs around and scores on the blind side. And that's the second level thinking. You've got to watch that eighth man and the scrummy. You know, they're going to throw us a dummy over there and score over here. And so that's hopefully what's going to happen, that the country scores on the blind side and that's people are not expecting. And that'd be amazing.
And you've met a lot of the politicians, a lot of the personalities. They've been at our conferences. They've come right through our conferences. Is there anyone who might be able to employ that kind of thinking should the unexpected happen? And I'm so glad to hear this because too often people are saying the unexpected isn't going to happen in South Africa, yet pretty much everywhere else in the world it has.
You know, I've been very encouraged by the people I met. Athol Trollope, amazing guy. You know, Herman Mashaba, so impressive. John Stiernes, and I didn't meet him, but I mean, he was a really impressive guy. So let's hope we've got people who are, you know, who want the best for the country and are not doing it for, I mean, what's Trump doing it for? You know, he's doing it for the glamour and the glitz and all of that sort of stuff, probably to keep himself out of jail. But our guys are not doing that. They're doing it big, you know, Herman Mashaba is not taking any money out of this. He doesn't need any money. He's doing it because he loves the country. And that's what we need. And so hopefully all those good people is part of the wholesale government management change that we need as part of a turnaround.
Sean Pesh, thank you.